Peter exhorted us, when we have problems, that we would cast our cares upon our God who cares for us. And in another verse, he said that we are to entrust our souls to a Creator that is faithful. And so we sang tonight, "Be still, my child. I have created all of life. Be still." That's easy to say when everything's going right. That's not easy to do when things are not going right. And what makes it difficult is that is the time when we trust God, or that is the time that it shows that our faith needs to grow, that we can get stronger in that. But the writer of that song, I believe, picked the right place to begin. And what he said in Genesis 1 at verse 1, "In the beginning, God." I meditate and think about that verse a lot. And don't even have to quote the rest of the verse. What happens is once you have said that, you have really set yourself to have a foundation for all of life. Because what happens is that when you say that in the beginning, God, that gives a purpose for life and for creation. The last few weeks I've been talking about this in a verse that I keep going back to, Revelation chapter 4, when all of the host of heaven are gathered before the throne of God. They said in verse 11, "Worthy art thou, O Lord our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they exist and were created." When God created, God had a purpose for what we're doing. They were to show forth His glory. The physical world does that. The heavens declare the handiwork of God. I read something interesting the other day. A father and his daughter were driving along and they saw one of these beautiful Arizona sunsets. And she commented, "If the backside of heaven is that pretty, can you imagine what heaven's going to be?" And the truth of the matter is, as we look around at the heavens and the glory of God, what we begin seeing is that God had a purpose for all that He has created, and that gives us a reason to be here. I'll talk more about that in just a second. God, in the beginning, gives us ethics. It is God that said this is wrong. As we were studying this morning from the book of Job, I found it fascinating, and y'all need to think about this. If we're right that Job really took place back sometime in Noah and Abraham's day, that was long before the law of Moses. And yet, the way Job lived his life in a matter of morals and ethics, we're not only in line with the fundamentals that God gave through Moses, they were in line with Jesus' understanding and application of that in the New Covenant. And what makes ethics so is the bottom line. God said so. And whatever else you want to say and argue about how you feel and what you think, and we're in the 21st century and all of those arguments, the difference really is all of it belongs to God. Not only in ethics, but also it gives us hope. It's always amazing to me, I've never heard of anybody except one who was an atheist that was asked specifically to talk at a funeral. There may have been some, I'm sure there must have been, but I've often wondered, so what do you say? At that point in time, because when Charlie's dead, there's no hope, there's no future, it's gone. Everything. But that's not true with us because God created us to live with Him, to glorify Him. That will not subvert God's purpose in this. So when you start and you say, in the beginning, God, you've given a foundation that you can live with. But you've also given some negatives. For the moment that you say, God, what you've denied is atheism. And when people say there is no God, then what they have also said is those three things we've talked about is there is no purpose. In fact, they write this all the time. Even about design in the universe, that it's not designed, it just looks like it was designed, but it's just an accident. And you're just an accident. And the universe is just an accident. And there was no purpose for the universe. And so, at that juncture, it's always fun to read the last chapter in their books. Because they try to then give us some type of reason for our existence. They just compelled to do that, it seems like. One writer I found very interesting. We find our purpose in the purpose of the universe. And he had just spent the whole first part of the book writing, there is no purpose to the universe. So I find my purpose in being part of a purposeless universe. My answer is, in the beginning, God. And I will rest on that. Atheism has no reason for ethics. Lions don't have a moral code. Elephants come closer than most of the animals. But it's not really a moral code. But when you come to humanity, we have a moral code. And we are incensed with people that don't live up to the moral code that we think ought to be there. And the interesting thing is, how do you get to a moral code if there was no God to begin with? And who makes it and who cares? And there is no hope. Atheism gives absolutely no consolation to a person that is dying. But we don't have to go there. You can all repeat after me. In the beginning, God. When you say that, you deny polytheism. Because it was not in the beginning gods. It was in the beginning God. And over and over and over again, what God has argued and shown is, there is none beside me. There is no other God but me. God was the creator, the sustainer, the giver of life, and the judge of all of the earth. And there is only one God. Paul said in 1 Corinthians, though there be gods many in the world, for us who understand, there is only one God. And so it's very narrow-minded, but that's what the beginning says. And the whole book teaches that. It denies materialism. We live in an age today where people have said all knowledge has to come through natural means and all answers to all questions have to come through natural means in order to be truth. And the first question that you ask is, who made that rule and how did they learn that through material science? And the answer is, you can't learn that rule through material science. The second question is, according to material science, why is there something rather than absolute nothing? We don't know. Why is there life out of non-life? We don't know. Why is there ethics out of material things? You know, I said lions don't have a moral code. Neither do rocks and trees. You don't get to the idea of ethics out of studies. When you said, in the beginning, God, that ends up denying pantheism because God created the heavens and the earth. And what you have now is God and has been God. there ever was anything to be pantheistic about. And God created the heavens and the earth, and therefore your chair is not God. And you are not God. And I am not God. And if you put all of us together, we're still not God. For in the beginning, God. And then comes the creation of all that we see and feel and experience. When you say in the beginning God, you deny fatalism. Because God did not have to do anything. He did what He wanted to do. His character, what He wants to do. But there is a freedom of will there. And when He created Adam and Eve, He set them a choice. When He gave the law of Moses, He said, I set before you life and death. And then He said, choose life. Throughout the Bible, what God said was, if you do this, this will be the consequence. And He set before us all this concept that we have a choice. Joshua said, choose you this day whom you will serve. Peter said in 2 Peter 3 that God is not willing that any should perish, but that all would come to repentance. But the problem with that is some people refuse to repent. They will stand before God in the day of judgment, but what I'm saying is this. We have choice. God is sovereign and God will hold us accountable for that and bring us to judgment for that. And in that, God chose His lordship and creatorship and sovereignty. But He's going to let us be dumb if we want to be dumb. He will let us do that which is wrong if we choose to do that which is wrong. And then we have to answer to God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What that then does is that gives you a foundation. I am still struggling. Wilson and I talk about this every year before we go to China. Because we're not happy with exactly all the results we've had when we get over there and talk with people. And part of it is, they're not Americans. They are Chinese. And they come from a different culture. They come with a different background. They have learned to speak English from British people. So even their English is different than our Americanized version of that. And almost everything that they have learned since Mao's great experiment, in which they simply did not have God. They did not talk about God. And life was presented from a materialistic, atheistic viewpoint. And so the whole concept of God is really somewhat foreign to their thinking process. So we walk over and we open up the book of Matthew and we begin teaching about Jesus and we've jumped into the middle of a story. And this is why I've said last week, 2 weeks ago actually, that the real story is the story of God. And the real story to talk about ethics and morals and sin does not begin with the cross. It actually begins back here with creation. And the idea that man is created with the ability to choose to do what is wrong doesn't start with Jesus. That started in the Garden of Eden. And so what we've been doing the last couple of times, and we're still thinking and studying and learning, and so in my thinking, this is what I began to look at. And so I asked myself a question the other day, as I was thinking about that. Well, I know what Peter said when he preached to the Jews in Acts 2. I even know what Peter said to Cornelius, who was a God-fearing man, which meant he was one of those that sat and studied with the Jewish synagogue, but he had not chosen to be circumcised yet. But what do you do when you walk into a country and a city where they don't have a clue about the true and the living God? Where do you start? I want to show you. Turn to Acts 17. I have a lot of friends that have gone on various trips over to Judea and Turkey and Greece. And one of the favorite things that preachers like to do is to stand on Mars Hill, where Paul stood, and then quote this sermon. A friend of mine asked me one day, wouldn't you like to do that? And I said, no, I can't do that. He said, sure you can, just save your money. I said, no, the money's not the problem. I can't quote the chapter. I could stand there and read on this. But here's what Paul said. City of Athens, it was a city that was given to idolatry, and they were very religious. And when Paul walked into the city, he looked around, and we have today still figures left over from the idolatry and what took place. And they gathered him together in the sight of all of the pagan philosophers that were there. And Paul, standing in the midst, verse 22 of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. And one of the things that I liked that Paul does with this is he doesn't start on a negative foot. He starts off, here's what I see. You are religious. And what I have found is, by and large, people have a religious bent, even those that have never studied religion. And there is this kernel that just seems to never go away on the idea that there has to be something more than this. That there has to be something of a spiritual side or a religious side. And they have the remnants because they remember grandma used to go to church. And so they have some of this left. And so here's where Paul started. He simply acknowledged, you are religious. But then he says, let me tell you about the God that you worship ignorantly. He considered, what therefore you worship as unknown, this I will proclaim to you. So, you don't start with the story of Jesus. He started with the story of God. And what he is going to do with the story of God, he's going to give them a basis in which the story of Jesus fits into. But he starts back here with God. And so what he says is, God. Verse 24, the God. And I know he didn't stop there, but I want you to stop there. Isn't that what Genesis said? In the beginning, God. Not a God, not one of the gods. The God. So Paul says, the God who made the world and everything in it. This is the God who is the creator of everything. And where did you all read that? Genesis 1 and verse 1. And so he begins with this story. And God then made everything in the world. And then everything, whether it be the trees or the people and the rest of the universe. And he says, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gave to all mankind life and breath and everything. This is the God. He made everything. And so when you begin talking to somebody, you start here. How did we get here? How did life begin? How did the universe begin? Why is there a right and a wrong? And so Paul started at this same place. And God created, and God created everything. And God is the Lord and the ruler over all of that. And the God that we serve did not need mankind to serve Him. It's an interesting thing when you study idolatry. What they do in idolatry is that they furnish everything for. Isaiah has a really cryptic statement about that and says, and what they have to do is they have to prop it up and then they have to nail it in place. to keep it from falling over. And then they put handles on it so that they can move it from one place to another because it's so impotent it cannot move itself, let alone be the creator of the heavens and the earth. But when Paul walks into this Areopagus, he simply says, the God that I'm telling you about is the God that created everything. It is the God that has no need of man to serve Him. He will give unto us the rules. And so not having any need, he also says, He thus is the creator of mankind. Verse 26. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined and allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. I'm going to give you a timeout, short sermon. This doesn't mean that God said we're supposed to stay on the earth and we can't go to the moon. Some people have used this verse to try to prove that what it really is talking about is God has determined ahead of time the boundaries of the nations, and God has determined the governments of the nations, and God has determined how we ought to live as people of any given nation. God is the God, not Pilate. God is the ruler, not Rome or Babylon. And this God rules over all of the nations. God raised up the Egyptians, and God raised up the Assyrians, and God raised up the Babylonians and the Romans. And so what Paul is saying here, this is not about governments and men. This is about God who sets the boundaries and the rules, and it is God that is the creator of all of this. And there is a purpose in creation. Verse 27. I'm reading out of the English Standard Version, but it's rather interesting to me, boring to most people. The first word is that. And when I read my Bible, I circle those little words when they appear at the front. Because the word that means in order that. Here's the purpose. Why did God create man and give man boundaries where to live? And the reason is in order that man might seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards Him and that they might find Him, yet He is actually not far from each one of us. There is a purpose in our existence. Find God. Now, when we go to China, you see how this fits? Where we start is not with the story of Jesus per se, but we start back here as Paul did. And what we're simply doing is putting before them is the purpose of our existence, and it is. And here is what we're trying to accomplish in our life. It's simply to find God in our life. And God can be found. The problem that we need to look for God, he says down here, verse 28, for in Him we live and move and have our being. And even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed His offspring, and being God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is gold or silver or stone or an image formed by art and the imagination of man. Now, we have an advantage when we go to China because we can take them down the street to the Buddhist temple. And on the way to the Buddhist temple, we can usually find various other shrines and idols unto the various gods and deities that are there. And we can simply reinforce again the very thing that we're talking about. God does not live in the rock. God does not live in this temple. These that you have here, they are not gods. They're not even a good image of God. They were created to be the image of God, but God is... How do you describe the difference? God is beautiful, God is invisible, God is just, God is powerful, God is omnipotent, God is omniscient, and here is an idol, and it can do nothing, and it is impotent. And so what we have is the ability to start where Paul started. Here is the story of God. And the problem is, you have distorted the very image of God. And I usually go to Romans chapter 1 at that point in time. What was the first and greatest sin? Not letting God be God. Eve, her real sin was not the eating of the fruit. Sin was in the heart. She wanted to be like God. For when you eat of that fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, then you will be like God. And she took it and ate. And she found out she wasn't God. And she found out Adam wasn't God. And she found out that there's more to being God than just knowing a little bit about knowledge of good and evil. And so God is different from all of that. And when people then have chosen to deny God or chosen to corrupt the image of God into a Buddhist temple or to an idol that is there, that they indeed have separated themselves from God. And at that point, we just turn back to the book of Genesis and we start reading again. And we read about what Adam and Eve did. And then we read about what the rest of the people did. Then we read about the Tower of Babel and Noah's flood. And then we get to Abraham, and from there we jump over a lot to Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. This is the story of Jesus, the son of Abraham, the son of David, and he came to fix the problem of sin. Paul introduces this, but notice how he introduces it. Verse 30. This time of ignorance God overlooked. But now he commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all people by raising him from the dead. Who is this man? Paul didn't tell him. Because the answer is not needed yet. The answer is not needed until they're convinced that what they've done is they've separated themselves from God, who is the Creator and the Judge. And the moment that he said, resurrection from the dead, everything just broke up. Because you realize dead people don't rise. The reason that people will say that is because they forgot where we started. In the beginning, God. Why would you think it incredulous, a God that can create everything that you see and feel and touch and smell and hear, and He created man and He gave to man life, why would we think it incredulous that He could give life to a body that has died? The problem is not the resurrection. Y'all see that? Problem is they have a wrong concept of God. So at that juncture, what Paul really needed to do is to back up and start his sermon all over again. Wait a minute, you've missed the point. Let me explain God to you yet again. In the beginning, God created. And see, you just quote this chapter over again. Until finally, they believe in God. And once we have gotten to the point where we believe in God, then we can give the rest of the story. What did God do? He is my God that gave Jesus. My purpose on being here is to glorify God. Sin does not glorify God. I've sinned. You know, one of the fascinating things to me, I look for little things like this. And one of the things that I've asked a lot of them is, do you think you've sinned? And even when they don't know anything about God, the answer is, yeah. They don't have to be convinced of that. They know that. Us arrogant Americans who refuse to acknowledge that our sinful ways are actually sin, we'll deny that we have sinned because sin is just your opinion of how things are going and what. Anyway, they're not encumbered with some of our American philosophy, which is good. So they acknowledge their sin, and then we can tell them the story in Jesus. You can be restored to that condition that God created us for. And Jesus died and was raised from the dead to give us an assurance that God will bring us to judgment, but God will be merciful to us in that judgment because of our faith and trust in Jesus. So therefore, Jesus told the apostles, go and preach this good news. But the good news is not just the story of Jesus. The good news began back here with the very purpose of creation. And now Jesus is going to fix that which is all messed up because of mankind and sin and rebellion. And when we then turn back to Jesus, not only, and I mentioned this the other day, not only are we restored in our relationship and forgiven of sin, do you all realize we have a hope of glory? We don't know what the body is going to be like yet. But we do know when He appears, we will be like Him. Glorified and immortal and fit to live with God forever the way God intended us to live. What a remarkable thing. And so not only will I be restored, but God will restore creation, a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness and no sin. And if the backside of heaven looks as beautiful as the sunset, the front side of heaven in the glory of God, you just don't want to miss. And this is the story of the Bible. And I think this really, we're seeing in America, we're having to present this more and more. Because I'm running into a generation of people that don't know God. They have no concept of the real character and nature and being of God. They've been told so many bad stories about God. And so I've been finding myself using this material more and more just in talking with people. And if you're here tonight and you believe in God and you know that you have sinned, the good news is Jesus came to fix that. And He died, and through that you can be forgiven. And you can have the hope of living with God forever. What a joy that will be. If you're ready to do that, Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. Both now spiritually and eternally in our relationship with God. And we want you to be part of that. Won't you come as we stand and sing?